Willkommen in Berlin Hauptbahnhof.
This is a Berlin story.
I'm Gisela Williams. Welcome to our Berlin Stories summer special. Our theme today is utopia, attempts at creating ideal communities and spaces in Berlin. The city has always been a mecca for escapists and alternative thinkers, from the bawdy cabarets of the Weimar Republic to the GDR's attempts to build a socialist ideal. The legend of a utopian post-wall Berlin was born of its kinetic Wild West underground nightlife and artists that hijacked the city's empty spaces. 25 years later, the city is going through some major growing pains. Legendary squats and clubs have been forced to shut down, rents are rising, and some streets are gentrifying faster than you can say fair trade coffee beans. But Berlin still attracts dreamers and artists, young and old, pioneers striving to create their version of an ideal community. Today, we examine a few of these experiments in post-wall Berlin, many of which literally emerged from the wasteland of the former Death Strip. All coming up on Berlin Stories.
Berlin Stories was recorded with the generous support of Studio Broad, your audio production partner in Berlin for voice recordings in dozens of languages, at studiobroad.com.
In an effort to develop more industry in Berlin, the city's policymakers are especially supportive of projects to transform the city into Europe's Silicon Valley. It's perhaps no longer an impossible goal. According to an October 2013 McKinsey report, two new startup companies are created in the city every day. Just this month, the city saw the much-anticipated opening of Factory. It's a complex of IT companies like Mozilla and SoundCloud that is built next to a strip of the former wall on the border of Mitte and Wedding. Before the opening, our reporter Rachel Stern headed to Bernauer Straße, a street that once divided east from west.
In 1961, residents here watched as a wall was constructed down the middle of the street, slowly obliterating their view of their neighbors. Now, graffitied chunks of the wall still stand here alongside an outdoor memorial. Next door is Factory Berlin, a historic brewery complex in various stages of construction.
We're here right on the border between East and West Berlin. We're on the east side of town, actually.
That's Factory founder Simon Schaefer giving me a tour.
Our premises are bordered by the Wall Memorial. So between the wall to the west and the wall to the east, there was a no man's land patrolled by border guards with guns and whatever else. And this is right next to our campus.
Factory is a mammoth space for Berlin's burgeoning tech scene to work, play, and swap ideas. Schaefer's company bought the complex in 2011. It officially opens this summer, but he's allowed companies to move in over the past few years. This winter, some early renters already cracked windows in the main building during a massive party.
We've had 100 people working here with 30 different nationalities, and they're actually sitting on the east side of town, working on technology that instantly is globally available and hopefully shapes the future.
At the age of 36, Schaefer is already a veteran of the Berlin startup scene, having invested in more than 36 tech companies. As he leads me through Factory's cavernous corridors and past construction workers, he points to a long back wall. It used to be part of the Berlin Wall.
There are two windows where supposedly the border police was standing with binoculars looking into the west, and we couldn't change those. But these are obviously great for meeting rooms and walls, idea walls with idea paint on them, where you can now write stuff on them.
Schaefer says unlike other co-working spaces in Berlin, the factory will not just include startups, but more established companies like SoundCloud and Sechs Wunderkinder. In the spirit of Berlin's nurturing startup scene, these bigger companies will be expected to mentor newer firms.
By concept, it's a mix. So from two people teams that just barely started to a 200-person company. When we're done, there'll be about 500 to 550 people working here.
SoundCloud, arguably Berlin's largest startup success story, will be the first company to move into the newly constructed main building. COO Mark Striegel says the layout of their 3,000 square meter space will reflect the company's culture.
We want to have the ability to have a really open space that we, you know, have people give them the opportunity to have the serendipitous interactions which you really need in an innovative company.
Unlike similar campuses in Silicon Valley, such as the Googleplex, much of Factory is open to the public, including a restaurant, co-working space, and event hall. There's also full service for the employees, a fitness center, dimly lit pub and club, and even a beer garden.
I'm very interested in the process of how work-life balance will be on one campus and campus life.
That's Berlin Chamber of Commerce startup coordinator Maria Konev.
You have everything you need in one place and you don't have to go to other places, and what it will make with your work-life balance. Maybe it turns it into work-work balance, or you don't feel like you work anymore because you just live on that campus.
That will be especially true for some of the people who rent out the flats in Factory, which will be available for overnight or longer-term stays. Schaefer hopes that will encourage companies from abroad to base themselves here at the site of the former wall.
You know, in the end, we're in a very historic place that tried to prevent influx of other cultures and tried to prevent a lot of things. And we're actually opening this space for innovation and for people to be a part of the future.
A future he hopes Berlin entrepreneurs will help shape. I'm Rachel Stern for Berlin Stories.
I'm Gisela Williams. When I hear the name Factory, I can't help but think of Andy Warhol and his famous Happenings. In Berlin, there are plenty of examples of art collectives taking over industrial spaces and creating a world of art, music, and never-ending parties. But lately, many of those art squats or communities, like Tacheles and Artitude, have been kicked out of their homes by the owners. A group called the Mind Pirates, however, mixes business with pleasure to stay afloat. They generate income with commercial projects and then funnel some of those earnings into cutting-edge art exhibitions and musical events. The Mind Pirates headquarters is a sprawling, multi-leveled space and a former grain storage on the Spree in Kreuzberg. The day we visited, director Ralf Schmerberg watched on as a crew of Mind Pirates set up for a concert later in the evening.
All the work tables and chairs and everything we did in this morning, and now we making this a concert room for tonight. What are the band called tonight?
Pitch.
So we have the Pitch tonight.
Schmerberg has spearheaded the roughly dozen-member collective since 2008. He's a slim, middle-aged man with a shaven head who's wearing a black turtleneck and jeans. His striking presence is exaggerated by the fact that he has two different colored eyes, one brown, the other blue. Dangling above his head from the tall ceiling is a cloud of dried grasses, an installation left over from a recent exhibition in the auditorium.
We used it as a studio, but we use it also as a concert space, as a cinema. What comes to our mind? Exhibitions, salon atmosphere, dinners.
In some ways, the Mind Pirates Clubhouse is a sleeker version of the artist squats that used to dot the city before developers started squeezing them out. The difference is here. Because of the commercial work they do, the Mind Pirates can pay their rent.
We work like maybe two-thirds on our own things, and one-third we work with others or on things that bring us some money. And this win-win allows us to work without somebody paying us, so we can self-pay ourselves. And that crazily works.
The group's biggest commercial project to date is a 2014 feature film commissioned by the Red Bull Music Academy. Schmerberg directed it and hired out the Mind Pirates to produce it. The collective's financing model mirrors Ralph's own career. He's directed commercials for brands including Nike, Levi's, and Fiat, so he can self-finance his films and photography.
I realized that this career allows me to do anything else I want to do on my own. And that's rare, and I don't know that it's a model everybody can follow.
So far, though, the Mind Pirates are successfully following it. The evening we visited, after the setup, guests streamed in and out of the auditorium during a four-hour experimental music set by Berlin avant-garde quartet, The Pitch. After the set, musicians spun vinyl for guests lingering on benches pushed up against the walls. Mind Pirate Malte Zahir mixed drinks late into the night.
Sometimes I have the feeling I'm living here because I'm 16 hours here or something. Coming at 10 and leaving at 8 in the morning.
But Zahir says that's the way he likes it.
We are family, we are friends. I don't want to leave here because it's a family for me.
A family, but with high-profile artist Ralph Schmerberg clearly at the head, bringing in essential paid work for the collective.
It's mostly like Ralph Schmerberg and Mime Pirates are produced by Mime Pirates. Mime Pirates don't can be exist without him, I think.
Schmerberg says the group doesn't really plan for the future and could break up next year. But he sees its impermanence as a good thing, an insurance policy against the collective outliving its relevance.
What I think is very promising, that's for me like the way out in my mind, to know like this can't be forever because we don't try to institutionalize it. Yeah, we live by this nature and we live with the moment and we don't take proper care of the future.
Schmerbeck says he's experienced utopias before. And the one thing he knows is that they don't last long.
They are fragile, and utopias, if we are able to make them manifest, they break easily and disappear again. But like a moment lived in an utopia is a never forgotten moment, I think. Once you had that, you keep that always.
That was filmmaker and head of the Mime Pirates Art Collective, Ralph Schmerberg. When writer Gideon Lewis Krauss lived in Berlin in the mid to late 2000s, he had many encounters with art communities, which he humorously describes in his memoir, A Sense of Direction. Here, in an excerpt from the book, he describes how Berlin's famous party scene can cause some artists to lose their way.
The first project of David Levine's I was in Berlin for was called The Gallery Will Be Relocating Over the Summer. It was a fake art opening that took its name from the fact that the real gallery that hosted it was supposed to be relocating over the summer. Then the gallerist had a kid with a young Spanish artist and was never heard from again. The fake opening was a final project for David's students in a class he was teaching. Each student spent an entire semester studying the habits and affects of an art world person, and showed up in character for the performance at the gallery in the Brunnenstrasse. All the newer galleries back then were in the Brunnenstrasse, and they would coordinate their monthly openings in a way that turned the street into a block party. These were my favorite evenings of that first year, drinking free beer in the 9 p.m. sunlight, parading around in the street, knowing that everybody you knew in the whole city was on that block and was going to the same after party. David's fake opening had fake real art on the walls, inspired by the real art of the characters under study, and real free booze, and a non-negotiable locked door duration of 4 hours. At 7 p.m., David Bicycle locked the front door of the gallery. The only person inside in character as herself was an arts reporter in town. The real opening, i.e. the opening of David's show, was in the courtyard outside, where we milled and drank the same free booze the fake people were real drinking inside. Occasionally, we looked in through the window to see what the fake attendees were up to. What they were up to looked largely the same as what we were up to, which was part of the point, but we were afraid that they were having a better time. After all, they had been licensed by hard work and careful direction to spend a few hours being different people, which meant they were drunkenly rolling around on the floor and wrecking the artwork and making the most of it. This made an even better point. We were ourselves at a real event, which meant our hearts weren't in it, not the way theirs were. The night was warm and there were a lot of free drinks and the after party sounded increasingly auspicious and it had been a while, I realized, since I'd had such a nice time out at yet another art function in Berlin. The doors to the fake opening were unlocked at 11. The New York arts reporter playing herself came out and held up her BlackBerry. Someone we knew in New York, or someone some of us knew and others had heard of, had gotten $750,000 for his novel, which apparently included whimsical drawings. The real news from the fake opening had seemed an ill omen. I'd been in Berlin for a year and had no better idea what I was doing there than I had when I arrived. I'd come to Berlin at least in part to escape what I saw as a kind of generational malaise, and had discovered there a slightly different kind of generational malaise. It had simply become a nonstop moral holiday, and we lived in it, and there was always someone in town from New York to show off for. Two friends visited and had a threesome with a tied-up Swede. They came to see Dawn and to cheat, and we took them out, and in the process allowed ourselves a great time. But as time went on, we felt less and less great about it. We finished the night at 7 in the morning, long after the sun had risen too early and too hot over the river at Bar 25. At 8 in the wintry morning coming out of Berghain, long before the sun painted its gray on gray in the slushy sky. At 11 in the morning, taking a regional train to a crummy Baltic beach to doze it off. The visitors were always ready to go home after an amazing week. It was their vacation, but it was our life, and it no longer seemed like what I'd wanted.
That was Gideon Lewis Krause in an excerpt from his memoir, A Sense of Direction. You're listening to Berlin Stories, a magazine of culture and ideas in Berlin. I'm Gisela Williams, and today we're talking about utopias, innovative urban projects unique to this ever-changing capital. In Berlin, it took a while for farm-to-table eating to take hold. Artists don't spend much money on food. But the revival of the historic Markthalle Neun in Kreuzberg is slowly changing the way Berliners understand where their food comes from. 5 years ago, the rundown but beautiful 19th-century brick hall was filled with chain shops like Kick and Aldi and a hangout spot for local derelicts. When the city announced a plan to sell it to developers, the neighborhood protested. In 2010, it was turned over to three partners who, after a year of renovation work, reopened it as a market with a social vision beyond just food. We met one of those founders, Nicholas Driesen, at the hall, a soaring industrial space with concrete floors, turquoise-painted metal beams, and aged mustard brick walls.
My name is Nicholas, and I'm together with my two colleagues, Bernd and Florian, we are running this market hall.
That's Bernd Meyer and Florian Niedermeyer.
Florian and Bernd, they both come from southern Germany. Both of them are very much into food. And since they were childs, basically, they always had the plan to actually do a market, to run a market.
Driesen studied economics and had previously been helping to build up microfinance institutions in Eastern Europe. He says he got involved with the market somewhat unintentionally.
I wasn't that much into food. I was just living across the road. And I came to the market one time, many times, but one time I had this idea and thought, like, why does it look that run down? And this might be something I want to put my energy in.
The three partners met and eventually were allowed by the city of Berlin to buy the hall.
And it was a good constellation because they had the concept and I knew the neighborhood. We are a good match.
The founders wanted to focus on local and sustainable products and creating a connection between farmers and consumers.
So we said we want to take it over step by step. And that means we started with the farmers market on Friday and Saturday and now slowly add new formats or have the market grow, actually.
In a way, Driesen says, his work hasn't changed much since his days in microfinance. He's working with small farmers and young entrepreneurs to give them a chance to build businesses centered in the market hall that meet the needs of the community.
It's a bit like a city. So the city needs to develop organically to also create its own identity.
The weekly event that has come to define Markthalle Neun's identity the most is Street Food Thursdays. Each week, tourists, hipsters, and longtime Kreuzberg residents crowd the market hall. They sample from a rotating cast of artisanal food stalls like Fräulein Kimchi's kimchi burgers and Big Stuff Barbecue's pulled pork sandwiches. Ursula Heinzelmann, a local food writer and author of the newly published book Beyond Bratwurst, says the event has made Markthalle Neun one of the most interesting and inclusive foodie destinations in the city.
It's not even fusion, it's coming together that I find in this place. There is on Thursdays all this great street food where actually you have to come in a group, because if you're on your own, you're really stressed out because you don't know what to choose.
This year, Markthalle Neun collaborated with one of the city's most important cultural events, the Berlinale, signing on as official caterers. They set up a half dozen of their food stands in the Potsdamer Platz. Filmmaker and Berlinale culinary cinema director Thomas Struck chose Markthalle Neun as the setting for one of the official dinners.
As we are slow food aficionados, we wanted to avoid, like the Markthalle, that this beautiful place was turned into some kind of a big supermarket.
Despite Markthalle Neun's popularity with hipsters and scene makers, at its heart, it remains a true community gathering place. Early one morning in January, farmers and political protesters were eating a breakfast hosted by the market hall, fueling up before heading to Potsdamer Platz, many of them on tractors, to protest big agriculture.
Okay, hello, my name is Iris Kiefer. I am from the team of We Are Haben Es Satt. That means we are fed up with agri-industry.
Wir Haben Es Satt, We Have Had Enough, is a grassroots organization that helps bring together small farmers and local businesses. Kiefer says Markt Hallenoyen is an obvious place to meet because it has long supported local farms.
It's a very, very important place in the last years for regional food, for good food, for agricultural products.
And while there are still two discount supermarket chains that rent out space in the hall, there's no real friction between customers. As Driesen, one of the owners, says, Markt Hallenoyen is much more than just a place to buy food.
It's such an important place if you look at the structure of a city. You have the church, you have the town hall, and you have a marketplace. And these are just places which are important for people to meet, to discuss, to find your first love. So that's what we are trying to be, a platform and the meeting place in terms of commerce, exchanging goods, but as well as exchanging ideas and bringing together people.
A marketplace for good food, ideas, and experiences.
Berlin Stories on NPR FM Berlin 104.1.
I'm Gisela Williams, and this is Berlin Stories. Not far away from Markt Hallenoyen, the Kreuzberg neighborhood of Grevekiez boasts the world's highest density of businesses that accept the virtual currency Bitcoin. As Rachel Stern reports, the decentralized digital money is increasingly being used for social good in Berlin.
You would like to pay for your tea? Will it be in cash or Bitcoin?
I scan my smartphone at the register, and €2.50 worth of Bitcoin are deducted from my online balance. Flores Cafe is one of more than 30 Berlin businesses that accepts the peer-to-peer electronic money. Owner Florentina Martins was drawn to the decentralized currency, which is produced by a community of programmers rather than a bank and exists only in accounts in the virtual world. There are no bills or coins changing hands.
I started accepting Bitcoins because I found it a very interesting and new way of accepting money. And I'm not dealing in cars. It's not huge amounts of money I'm dealing in. And Bitcoin is a very progressive and new and cool way of accepting money with no banks or no other people coming in between.
Floris is in the cozy Grevekiez neighborhood, which is often dubbed Bitcoin Kiez. It used to border the Berlin Wall and is known for being a historical hub of rebellious free thinkers. Room 77, a bar and restaurant in the area, is famed for being one of the first businesses in the world to accept Bitcoin in 2011.
Of course, first, hardly anybody used it. Only the three or four other enthusiasts in town used it. They used to type 34 digits into their keyboard in order to pay their beer.
Now owner Jörg Pletzer says about 10% of customers there pay for their beer, burgers, and burritos with Bitcoin. But Bitcoin aficionados in Berlin aren't just techies looking to swipe a QR code on their Androids. They're also idealists and entrepreneurial thinkers like Johann Barbie, who gravitate to what they consider the first truly global currency. Barbie and his partner, Songyi Lee, started a company called 37 Coins that makes it possible to transfer Bitcoin via text messages to the developing world. Unlike traditional currencies, there are no or very small costs to send or receive Bitcoin.
The fees from Western Union and MoneyGram, they're really pretty big in the remittance market. And this is just a perfect use case to take 37 Coins and make it grow in an environment where it's just so much more competitive.
For Berlin-based science fiction author S.E. Sever, Bitcoin is simply an easy money transfer tool to support authors on her writing competition website, mashstories.com.
The money you sent goes to the writer directly. And I think this is a very important thing, especially for budding writers. They need the reader's support.
Not everyone in Berlin is a big fan of Bitcoin, though. Free University of Berlin economist Raoul Rojas says Bitcoin's value fluctuates too wildly with supply and demand. Bitcoin users are also limited to a narrow demographic. According to Rojas, 96% are men with the average age of 32.
Most of the time it's geeks. Young men who are in love with their computers and want to have everything which is new and modern, and they are the innovators.
Indeed, young innovators cluster at three Berlin Bitcoin groups every month. When I visit the monthly Bitcoin Stammtisch at room 77, people spread out on the couches discussing Bitcoin projects. Many line up to purchase the currency at the new Bitcoin ATM here, the first in Germany. One of the regulars is Heidi Leighton, a Berlin tour guide who takes her clients past the Bitcoin hotspots of Grafenkiez.
I feel like the Bitcoin Kiez in Berlin will be remembered something like Paris at the turn of the century, where you get lots of intellectuals with different skills, programmers instead of artists perhaps, gathering together and discussing how to use this technology to change the future.
A change that will be made one Bitcoin transaction at a time. I'm Rachel Stern for Berlin Stories.
The economic crisis has made some people believe that it is time for an alternative economy. Bitcoin is an example of that. Another is the gift economy and bartering movements. In Berlin, one of the most popular bartering projects is one started in 2010 by Swedish expat Malin Elmlid, called The Bread Exchange. Her book, also called The Bread Exchange, is being published by Chronicle Books this fall.
I was working as a sales manager in the fashion industry, where size matters. Either you fit in the sample size, or you might just as well start looking for a new job. Many of my colleagues cut carbs to be able to stay slim, and so did I. No potatoes, no pasta, no problem. But to give up bread? I couldn't do it. So I compromised. I told myself that I would only eat good bread, baked with dedication, high-quality ingredients, and traditional methods. So suddenly I was baking. I was baking like crazy to make the perfect loaf. On the rare occasions that my loaves reached the high standard that I set for myself, I gave them away to friends and neighbors. And then these friends passed them on to their friends, because I was simply producing too much bread for our small circle to consume. Then one day, a friend of a friend wanted to return the gift. His father was playing the viola at the Berlin Philharmonic. He had two free tickets, so he gave one to me. And that is how the Bread Exchange started. I started posting about my baking on a blog, and then I started an online group for the Bread Exchange so I would be able to connect with potential traders. We coordinated virtually, and then we met face to face to trade anything and everything. The group became a great way for me to reach people that I would never have met otherwise. And the Bread Exchange nourished my passion for stories, and in turn, the stories I gathered enriched the bread. It's no mistake that the Bread Exchange was born in Berlin, a city open to creative ideas of all kinds. Berlin is not a rich city, but yet many people live really rich lives here without earning much money. This was a fertile place to start. Looking back now, I know that the night at the Philharmonic changed my life, because since then, the Bread Exchange has spread across the world. I've traded with people on every continent, and every trip I've taken has taught me something new. Every person that I met along the way has told me a story that touched me somehow. Why don't you sell your bread is a question I get every other week. Well, you tell me what would be a fair price for it. I only make two or maybe four loaves at a time, and to make one loaf takes me about 24 hours. If I set a price that would reflect my investment and my hourly pay rate, no one would be willing to pay for it. But now, instead of money, I receive something that is way more valuable to me than any amount of money on this planet. I receive stories and inspiring encounters and expanded horizons. And this is what I bake my bread for.
That was Malin Elmlid, founder of The Bread Exchange and author of a book by the same name that will be published this fall.
Du bist so wunderbar, Berlin.
Stories was recorded with the generous support of Studio Broad, your audio production partner in Berlin for voice recordings in dozens of languages, at studiobroad.com.
This is Berlin Stories, a magazine of culture and ideas. I'm Gisela Williams. Today, we're speaking to people striving to create their version of utopia in Germany's dynamic capital. Bar 25 was one such attempt at hedonistic transcendence. The legendary club was a collection of wooden shacks and art installations located on the Spree. Think Burning Man meets Studio 54. In 2010, several years after it first opened, Bar 25 was forced to leave the site. This year, against all odds, some of the founders are back with a 75-year lease, millions of euros from investors, and a project called Holzmarkt. How did a group of eccentric partiers and artists manage to beat the system? We trace the history of the popular Spreeside clubs to find out, starting with Burkhard Kieker, the CEO of Visit Berlin. He remembers the early days of Bar 25.
It was a kind of revolutionary concept. People thought this is a freak show. The guys used to run around in zebra costumes over the weekend. Also, a lot of dope was around, just as the bank of River Spree.
The club got so popular so fast, Kieker says the door policy got tougher and tougher.
So they introduced a new measure, and it was whoever is willing and able to swim from the other bank of River Spree to Bar 25 was very much welcome. They were greeted with cheers, and this was the best way to pass by the doorman.
Bar 25 pioneer and Holzmarkt CEO Yuval Dietziger told us that before his friends started Bar 25, they'd been throwing mobile parties out of a trailer, trying to stay one step ahead of the police.
And then suddenly they found this beautiful hidden garden on the Holzmarkt. It was actually a rubbish place, but the nature's claimed back the concrete.
They asked the owners if they could rent the land for the summer.
And we done like a kind of illegal shack we built with old houses. They break out. We gave the builders beer. We put the stereo in and we sold beer. And we have no license, nothing. We just done it.
Because they didn't own the land, their situation was always insecure. They spent several summers protesting both the threatened closing of the club and the Mediaspree, a city plan to develop the riverside with luxury high-rises and office buildings.
People here said, we don't want only offices on the riverside. We want to hang out on the riverside. We want to have nice plans. We want bars and things like this and not only offices.
But in 2010, Bar 25 was forced to shut down for good.
In the end, they found a way to how to kick us out.
A few of the Bar 25 gang, Dietziger included, were allowed to take over an abandoned soap factory across the river for 2 years. There, they built up the Katerholzig, a graffitied complex of dance floors, studios, and cultural spaces. This time around, because they had to invest almost €1 million into the infrastructure, they were forced to make money. Income was generated at the popular upscale restaurant hidden on the third floor and by renting out space for corporate events.
This was, in the first year, very hard for us, that we actually have to sell our soul also a little bit to get the money back. In the end, everybody thinks we're getting really rich, but actually we didn't get rich, but we had a very successful time. And it was actually for this project now very important that we had something like this.
At the same time that they were running Katerholzig, the founders were attempting to buy land for their next visionary project, the Holzmarkt, a sort of village built around dance music and art. The leadership approached investors and built up a community of supporters to get funding. Visit Berlin's Burkhard Kieker says while the city didn't give the Holzmarkt financial help, it did buy the project essential time by holding the land until the founders could find investors. At this point, political leaders had learned to understand the value of pirate-style projects like Katerholzig and Holzmarkt.
They were prepared to say, okay, don't have the next office building. We want to maintain the very special place of Holzmarkt.
Ultimately, Holzmarkt convinced a Swiss pension fund to buy the original site of Bar 25 and lease it to them for 75 years. It took them years of fighting, but finally the artists won. Dietziger says it's because they never took no for an answer.
And I think this is one of the main things what's important, that when I travel around the world, that you just have to do it. Just try and talk with the police and talk with the politics. When they say no, you can ask why no, but you have to do it.
It's in its very early stages, but the Holzmarkt is Bar 25, reinvented as a village. As early as this month, there will be a club, a restaurant, and a juice bar, as well as the beginnings of a park and permaculture gardens. Eventually, there will be studios for DJs, a hotel, a school for sustainable business, and even a 24-hour daycare. Kieker says that the city is still fertile ground for the unexpected.
Berlin is still open for utopia. If you have a crazy idea, you still can make it in Berlin, if you really want it.
As I left the Holzmarkt complex after our visit, something across the river caught my eye. On the opposite bank of the River Spree, I saw a village of teepees. Sandwiched between techno clubs and new luxury apartment blocks, about 40 people were living off the grid on a piece of overgrown wasteland formerly part of the Berlin Wall. We sent reporter Thalia Gigerenzer across the Spree to find out what this cluster of teepees was all about.
I'm on the western bank of the Spree, walking through a field of trash and broken bottles. I stop in front of a colorful, hand-painted entrance arch that says, "Welcome to Teepee Land." Here I meet Oliver from London, who shows me around. He tells me Teepee Land is not like other squats in Berlin.
I mean, I don't like the word squat, actually, because it's public, and it's for the public. I wouldn't say we're squatting, we're developing. This is a living, cultural, public, private, community space, and it's for everyone.
We head along a public path dotted with flower gardens. So far, the community hasn't been asked to vacate this prime real estate. Oliver says teepee landers are counting on a loophole in the squatting laws.
Apparently teepees are not listed in German law. Tents are mentioned, but not teepees.
Oliver leads me into the kitchen, where we hear a flurry of different languages. People from all over the world, from Bulgaria to Japan, live here. But it all started with one man. Like every sovereign country, Teepee Land has a founding myth. Roll from Lithuania tells the tale.
In the times of young gods and ancient demons, it was cruel war between order and chaos, between Teepee Landers and punks.
At the heart of this chaos was Fliga, who founded Teepee Land 1.5 years ago. He first pitched his teepee here after fleeing from another squat on Kövlistrasse, which had become infamous for its drug-fueled violence. I go to meet the chief himself in his tall, white teepee.
Hello?
Yeah, come on. It's my teepee. Take a look.
I'm greeted by a giant man with long white hair dressed all in black with snakeskin cowboy boots. He looks like a cross between an Indian chief and a Hell's Angels rocker. I've just caught him after a hearty meal.
Yes, I'm eating fish. I was eating very much fish today. Boah, my belly is fat.
So where did you get the fish from?
From the Spree. Oh, okay. From the water here.
I ask Flieger about the Kövlistrasse squat he fled from, and his face darkens. But there was something else that drew him to this urban wilderness.
I was here years ago with this belly dancer from Turkey. It was very romantic, and then she was gone, I don't know why. And I was sad, and I remember, oh, there's a nice place in the past. I have to go to make a teepee there.
Now, he says he's found peace here in this oasis by the Spree.
The river is repairing my soul. I'm getting up very early. And then I go to the water, speaking with a duck. Yes, there's a duck. And then I go back in my teepee and look Winnie the Pooh movies.
But even utopia can sometimes be disturbed, especially when it's surrounded by clubs like Holzmarkt.
I hope they will not be too loud. I need to rest here sometimes. I don't like this kind of music. I'm a rock and roller. No techno. I hate techno.
As I'm about to leave, Fliga invites me to live here.
I hope you will stay here longer in Teepee Land.
Yeah.
If you need to stay here overnight, we have a tourist camping place. The river has to be for everybody, not for only for the rich. It's not good.
TP-landers are learning, though, that their hospitality sometimes comes at a cost. In the middle of the village, there's a half-dismantled teepee that belonged to an ex-community member.
This member of the community was a strong alcoholic, sometimes very aggressive. A month ago, we kind of gave him an ultimatum to kind of like try and calm down. It's a difficult situation, and I think a community should be able to take care of someone like that. But we're not strong enough to.
Life in teepee land isn't always easy. Some people are refugees, and most live off of collecting bottles from the nearby clubs. But to people like Chris Hahn, a friend of Fliga's and guitarist for the experimental rock band The Swans, it's this life on the fringe that makes teepee land one of the last remaining bastions of Berlin's alternative culture.
It would be like a colony on Mars. You know, like this is planet Berlin and raving capitalism and, you know, creatures, and then there's some civilized people from outside who create a little colony there.
On a warm night in April, Teepee Land is celebrating its first birthday with a public open mic party. Around 30 people sit around a blazing fire, listening to acoustic guitar. Roel has been running around all night organizing.
You know, it's not so difficult to build teepee. The most difficult thing is to create really, how to say it, atmosphere of this place. It sounds stupid a little bit, like hippie bullshit, yeah, but it's true, it's just reality. We're trying to live in peace.
Halfway through the party, a glass bottle crashes to the ground. Immediately, two men rush to clean it up. It may seem like a small gesture, but it's one step closer to making this overgrown wilderness a home. I'm Thalia Gigerenzer for Berlin Stories.
Some people might find Berlin's abandoned lots and empty, undefined spaces disturbing. Others, like the novelist Brittany Sonnenberg, find them strangely freeing. She speaks now about her favorite in-between space in the city.
It's no big deal to fall in love with Berlin. Everyone does. Berlin is like a disheveled painter in college with startling green eyes and a bashful southern accent. Irresistible. Your first 6 months, everything is swoony. The battered furniture in bars, the swans on the canal, the city's profound bikeability. The question is, how do you stay in love? How do you keep seeing utopia on your 40th straight day of slate gray skies? For me, the consistently utopic can be found in Berlin's wild, unsanctioned spaces. I'm not talking about Berghain's dark rooms. I'm talking about the city's abandoned lots. My second year in town, someone showed me a vacant lot in Mitte that could have been a field in Brandenburg. Queen Anne's lace, daisies, and thistles erupted in tangled blossom. Even though it is out of my way, I often bike through this lot on my way to the office for a break from the concrete. It isn't just the greenery and the dirt path that I like. It's the slight lawlessness of the lot, its liminality. It feels secretive and unpredictable, like someone's oversight. It does not have a name on Google Maps. It is a quiet loophole, stuffed with weeds and wildflowers. Such incomplete spaces in Berlin make the city feel roomy to me. I relish the suggestion of unfinished business, of potential. As a foreigner, I'm always trying to fit in, to keep my visa valid, to pronounce German words correctly. I feel this pressure most strongly on Prenzlauer Berg's stately streets or in the echoing halls of the Alte Nationalgalerie. But who is an abandoned lot to judge my unbelonging? It is an interloper itself, a temporary dweller. Its scrappiness lends me courage every time I bike through. Hold your ground, it says. Grow. I also get that shivery sense of freedom in Tempelhof Feld, an airport that was miraculously converted into a park. But the park's official status can interfere with its dreamy, the apocalypse happened and that turned out to be a good thing vibe. Last summer, my friend and I had spread a blanket over some grass and were enjoying camembert and apples. Then, above the chirping crickets and trills of swallow song, we heard a jeep pull up. This area is strictly for the birds, said a park policeman, without a smile, since it wasn't a pun in German. You need to take your picnic elsewhere. We promised him we would, and then went back to snacking and gossiping after he drove off. 5 minutes later, he was back. Seriously, you need to move, he said, looking even more stern. We obliged, grumbling. Weren't parks for people? How did birds suddenly get so much clout? Since when did they pay taxes? Such an encounter is unthinkable in my prized abandoned lot. But the absence of surveillance has never made the lot feel unsafe. I've never come across needles or witnessed any sketchy goings-on, though I've restricted my lot traipses to daylight. The scariest things are bounding St. Bernards and thistlethorns, neither of which bother me very much. Unfortunately, the last time I biked through the lot, I spotted something distinctly dystopic, a sign advertising an apartment complex. We'll see. My hope is that it's an empty threat, the way the German government rejected my freelance visa application a couple times before grudgingly allowing me to stay. And if I lose the utopia of my abandoned lot in Mitte, I'll just have to find something else. Maybe abandoned shops. I know a bubble tea chain that hasn't had a customer in years.
That was novelist Brittany Sonnenberg talking about her love for Berlin's undefined spaces. You're listening to Berlin Stories. I'm Gisela Williams. For our final report in today's summer special, a look at a very different kind of utopian project. Berlin has always been famous for its bridges, from the iconic Oberbaumbrücke with its twin Gothic towers to Wannsee's Glienickebrücke, famously used for the exchange of spies during the Cold War. Our reporter, Thalia Gigerenzer, found another to add to the list, a bridge unlike any other in the city.
The bridge, in the city's eastern district of Köpenick, is about as wide as your finger and serves a, well, highly select group of the city's residents.
The European squirrel is small and sweet and kind of funny, so...
That's Ursula Bauer, who works for the animal rights organization Aktion Tier, and was the driving force behind Berlin's first squirrel bridge. I met Bauer at the bridge a few days after it was inaugurated this March. It's a rope tied between two trees 9 meters above the ground.
The rope is from tree to tree, 21 meter. The rope is big and strong, like a rope from a sailing ship or so.
This crossing has been particularly dangerous for squirrels.
The problem here at the Müggelsee Dam is that lots of squirrels has been killed by cars. Last year died around about five squirrels.
That's right, five. Maybe not enough to upset the ecosystem, but enough to unsettle the neighborhood's two-legged residents. It all started with a panicked phone call from an employee at the Institute for Water Ecology across the street.
And he told me, oh, one of the squirrels was dead and it was a mother and the babies might die also and we must do something. I've heard about a squirrel bridge. What about making a project about it? And then I fought with the institutions. They had to say okay for this and that.
This being Germany, everything had to be regulated. It took Bauer months to find a certified tree climber to install the rope and a company to insure it. But unlike many current construction projects in the city, Bauer says there's been no opposition so far from the local residents.
Because the squirrels are so lovely, everybody likes them. They are funny, they are nice.
Berlin has always been a very animal-friendly city. Dogs are welcomed in many cafes and restaurants. When the Berlin Zoo's celebrity polar bear Knut died suddenly, even the mayor Klaus Wowereit issued an official statement expressing his grief. There's even a city employee whose sole job it is to protect Berlin's wildlife.
It's said that we have one of the largest wild animal populations in capital cities in Europe.
That's artist Susanna Hertrich. She recently created an exhibition in which she built utopian structures for animals in Berlin, like a raccoon house.
The speciality of Berlin is that you have these green spots and abandoned spaces throughout the city so that if an animal comes from the outside, they can basically migrate all the way up to Alexanderplatz without being disturbed. But that is a very unique situation, that you can actually meet wild boar at night on Alexanderplatz. If you're lucky, you can see a fox riding the elevator in the middle of the night.
Hertrich says that animals have often benefited from the city's unique political situation.
Berlin is a divided city, had a lot of abandoned spaces, and these were perfect hiding places for animals. The sort of the death zone along the Berlin Wall was apparently a utopia for rabbits.
But if Cold War era Berlin was cozy for some, the period shortly after the fall of the wall was one big party, and not just for techno revelers.
Because then suddenly these spaces, let's say along the River Spree, which was the natural border between East and West, became accessible not just for people partying in these empty buildings, but also for animals to walk in and find a hiding place.
But the decline of the Spree as a haven for squatters also means the beginning of the end of the area as a sanctuary for animals. Gentrification in other parts of the city has a similar impact, says Rosie Koch, a filmmaker who recently made a documentary about Berlin wildlife.
For example, swifts. They live in old buildings, in cracks, where the roof hits the walls. And as soon as they renovate these houses, these cracks and holes disappear completely.
But in the not yet gentrified outer districts of Berlin, Ursula Bauer is making sure the city's furry residents enjoy a high quality of life. And she may have started a trend. When the bridge was inaugurated, the city's wildlife expert was flooded with phone calls from people all over Berlin requesting bridges.
Our bridge is the second one in Germany and the first one in Berlin, and I swear not the last.
Rosie Koch hopes that with projects like the Squirrel Bridge, Berlin will remain a city where intimate encounters with animals are part of everyday life.
To be out at night, to come home from a party and be face to face with a wild fox, it's just, yeah, it's like a little miracle. And then this animal doesn't attack, it doesn't do anything, it just looks at you, and then it keeps on walking, and you feel attached by nature.
In the end, it's not just the city's animals that benefit from keeping Berlin wild. I'm Falia Gigerenzer for Berlin Stories.
I'm Gisela Williams. Thank you for joining us for this special episode of Berlin Stories, a magazine of culture and ideas in Berlin, founded by myself and Anna Winger. This episode was produced by Carolyn Beeler and Thalia Gigerenzer. Special thanks also to Rachel Stern, Nick Simpson, Anna Winger, and Oliver Brode. For more on all these stories, please go to our website, berlinstories.org. And to stay informed about future episodes of Berlin Stories, like our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at Berlin Stories FM.
Berlin Stories on NPR FM Berlin 104.1.